Hello and welcome to the Communication Corner. I'm Dr. Bill Lampton, your host. Every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. on WBCX-FM, the voice of Brunel. Also, this program is rebroadcasted Thursday at 6 a.m. for those of you who start your days quite early. Along with program producer Christina Rhodes here today. Gosh, I wish you could see her ever-present, effervescent smile. As you know, she's the station manager. And gosh, Christina, we're going to have a meeting tonight with the WBCX staff, pizza included and provided, so I'll get to meet other program hosts who broadcast their programs. Well, in the Communication Corner, as our listeners know, I am committed to bringing you top-level professional guests, very high achievers in their chosen fields, who have demonstrated their communication expertise repeatedly and have special tips and strategies to share with us. I hope you'll tell your friends and professional colleagues to join us in the Communication Corner. Today's guest is someone that I've known and admired for a very long time, and to tell you how we met, I have to go all the way back to 1971 when I first started hearing the name Phil Schaefer. Phil Schaefer at that time was a sports director for WSB Radio, one of the leading radio stations in the South and, in fact, in the nation. And WSB launched a program, a contest, slated around the Atlanta Golf Classic, which was rather new then. I was a very avid golfer, had been since I was 13 years old. I was very excited about the contest they were running because the winner of the contest would get to come to the Atlanta Golf Classic at the Atlanta Country Club, where it was held then, co-host the broadcasting with Phil Schaefer, walk out on the course, interview top players. It was a golfer's dream. So that first year that they ran the contest, 1971, I followed the application procedures. I sent in a detailed letter about my communication skills and background and also my golf ability so I wouldn't embarrass the course too badly in the pro-am. I never heard from WSB. I know you, too, have had times when you wanted something badly enough that you just kept going after it. So the next year, 1972, I applied again, this time, I suppose, with a slightly different letter since the first one didn't work. Much to my delight, about 10 days before the contest, I got a call from Phil Schaefer. I was sitting in my office at the University of Georgia, where I was on the speech communication faculty. Phil called to see whether I could put two sentences together without stumbling while he was interviewing me and to see what I might sound like on the radio. Also to find out if I had a legitimate golf handicap, which I had quoted in my application. After we talked for a few minutes, Phil said to me, "Bill, suppose you were selected. You know the tournament starts in just 10 days. Could you get away from your job?" And I was thinking, should I answer to Phil, "I will leave my job if you select me." Much to my delight, just a couple of days later, Phil let me know that I was the fortunate winner. And so that week, starting with the Pro-Am on Wednesday, I can still remember, Phil, I had a 7:38 tee time that morning. My muscles and brain don't usually get started for golf that early. But I had a wonderful time playing, and then the rest of the week, Phil, I still have the tapes now on a CD, which you saved for me, where I interviewed Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, and the eventual tournament winner, Bob Lund. You and I, Phil, will be going way back in memory when we note that the winner's prize, the champion's prize, was $25,000, which probably 30th place in a regular PGA tournament got. But I had wonderful a wonderful occasion there, and Phil and I have fortunately kept in touch over the years. In fact, and I'll mention this again at the end of the program, if you go to YouTube and type in my name, Bill Lampton, you'll find my list of videos that I have produced. One of them is a video interview with Phil Schaefer just a few months ago. So I think you'll want to see Phil in action there as well. Well, in 1972, when I became acquainted with Phil Schaefer, and then later, I learned that during Phil's broadcasting career, he earned and kept the respect of leading players in every major sport. Here's some leading testimonials about Phil Schaefer as a broadcaster that I want to share with you. And at the end of the program, I'm going to tell you where I got these. This from Phil Niekro, Baseball Hall of Fame. Since 1963, my friend Phil Schaefer has been in and around locker rooms of the greatest athletes the Braves, the Falcons, the Hawks, the old Atlanta Flames, and the Georgia Bulldogs have ever known. From Jeff Blauser, Atlanta Braves shortstop. Phil was as much of a mainstay in the Braves clubhouse as Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz. His insight and knowledge of the game made him a trusted one of the guys, a true professional, and an even better friend. Fran Tarkenton, Pro Football Hall of Fame. Phil Schaefer was involved with the Bulldog Nation for over three decades. Kevin Butler, College Football Hall of Fame. No one person was in touch with the growth of Atlanta sports more than Phil. To this day, Phil and his wife give back to the Atlanta community by bringing the athletes from the past and present together to benefit others. Never selfish, Phil has always put his love for Atlanta first. I have received many awards over my career, but the compliments I have received from Phil on my high school sports achievements are certainly at the top. And then there's a guy named Jack Nicklaus. Some of you might have heard of him. Jack Nicklaus said, "Every year when I came to Augusta, one of the familiar faces I enjoyed seeing and one of the people I always looked forward to talking to was Phil Schaefer. Phil was just one of the good guys who've been going to the Masters almost as long as I have and has interviewed me countless times, each time with notable ease and professionalism and unspoken trust." Well, after that sterling introduction, I'm happy to welcome Phil Schaefer. Phil, welcome to the Communication Corner.
Who are you talking about there?
I hope your wife was listening.
Yeah.
And your friends and your buddies. Quite a tribute from some wonderful names in sports. As I look back over your career, Phil, I believe I can use the word precocious about you, because as a student at Ohio State, you gave great promise as a broadcaster. Let's have you explain to us your involvement quite early in your college career with station WOIO, the campus station at Ohio State.
I walked into WOIO as a freshman, and after my first two quarters, I was intent on getting good enough grades to stay in school. I was really concerned about that. So after my first two quarters, I felt confident enough to walk into the student radio station and tell them that I was interested in being a sportscaster, that I wanted to do baseball play-by-play. And they said, "Well, we've got about six guys that are in front of you." And I said, "Okay, well, I'll wait my turn."
Had you ever been on the air before then?
No.
Pretty audacious, weren't you?
Well, I felt like I had to start somewhere, and I wasn't going to be able to make the Ohio State baseball team, so I thought at least I could do is go out and broadcast their games. And
you played some high school baseball.
Yes, played high school baseball back in North Augusta, South Carolina, and have some great stories about my high school days. But at any rate, I went into the university station, and I told them what I wanted to do, and I thought, well, I'll just wait and see what happens. And I don't know how it happened exactly, but a week before the first games were to be broadcast, the station manager called me up, and he said, "Are you ready to do some play-by-play baseball?" And I said, "Sure, when?" He said, "Well, Saturday, we want you to do a doubleheader." So I went out on that Saturday. I did have a broadcast partner, and we sat there, and I did a baseball doubleheader. And I thought, this is fun. This is really great. But as part of my
were you the sole broadcaster?
No,
for the
I
game?
Was. No, I had a partner.
Mm-hmm.
But we did a doubleheader, so that day I ended up doing 9 of the 18 innings, and actually it probably wasn't 18. They probably did a 7-inning first game because it was college baseball. It was the Ohio State baseball team, and so I did the doubleheader. But then they said, if you're going to be working at this station, you also have to do some other things. So I had to do some news, and they gave me a disc jockey show. And I'd done a doubleheader. I'd been on the air for like 4, maybe 5 hours. I can't remember how long it took, but I really enjoyed it. Then I went in to do this disc jockey show, and I sat down in this studio, and it was me and a mic and a turntable and some music. And I sat there, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this is terrifying. It was nothing like doing a baseball game. A baseball game was a walk in the park compared to sitting in a studio and talking to a wall.
Because baseball, you were watching action and
right.
describing it.
Right.
This time you had to make the action.
Right. And I'll never forget sitting down thinking, what in the world do I say? What do I do? So I had a great experience at WOIO. And then the next year, they made me the sports director.
Your sophomore year?
My sophomore year. My junior year, they made me the program director. My senior year, they made me the program director and the station manager. So I had a great opportunity there. It was a great chance to learn, actually to go, sit down and learn how to be a broadcaster. And play radio is what I called it.
And then baseball was not all that you broadcasted there.
No, I was the next year, Ohio State had a new head basketball coach by the name of Fred Taylor. And I went to Coach Taylor and I said, Coach, I'm going to be broadcasting the Ohio State basketball games on WOIO, and I want to learn as much as I can about Ohio State basketball. And he said, I'll tell you what, if you want to come in and watch film with me at any time, you're welcome. And what happened after that was 3 days a week, I would go to Fred Taylor's office. I'd go in early in the afternoon. We'd sit down. He'd put film on, and I'd sit there for an hour and basically listen to him just talking about what we were watching on film. And I really learned basketball from Fred Taylor. And it meant so much to me because not only did it help me as a play-by-play man, but later in my career, when CBS Radio came to me, they wanted to use me as an analyst. So I was able to fulfill that role as well, because CBS liked the fact that I was versatile and could do play-by-play. I could be an analyst. I'd done pregame shows for them, halftimes, postgame shows, and all sorts of stuff.
I doubt that many people who had broadcasting majors I doubt that many had the opportunities that you did for live broadcasting. They had a lot of classroom work, but I doubt that many in any school, much less Ohio State, had those on-air opportunities that you had, so that by the time you completed your undergraduate degree, you are truly a veteran sports broadcaster.
Well, I was so fortunate because in the summer after my sophomore year at Ohio State, WBBQ in Augusta hired me to do news and sports, and they gave me a news car and put me out on the street, and that was a great summer. And then the next summer when I came back, they hired me to be a disc jockey. And actually, what happened was they signed off at 1 o'clock in the morning, and they were the top dog in Augusta at that time. So I was very fortunate to be at that station. But after 6:30 at night, I was the only man in the station. I was the whole show. So they showed great faith in me, and here again, I was really piling up the experience. And then when I went back to Columbus, I had other jobs there. I worked at a station called WRFD in Worthington, Ohio. I worked at WBNS-TV on the floor crew. And then, of all things, my senior year at Ohio State, WTVN Radio lost their sports director. And they were going to do the Ohio State basketball games. And Fred Taylor called up WTVN and recommended me for the job. So there I am, a senior in college at Ohio State, traveling with the number one team in the country, broadcasting all their games, home and away.
They had the top players in the nation then.
Right. They had Jerry Lucas. They had Larry Siegfried. They had John Havlicek, Mel Knoll. They had a reserve forward by the name of Bobby Knight. It was a heck of a team. We played for the national championship 3 straight years. We were in the championship game.
And you went to the tournament and broadcasted it.
As a senior, I'm sitting there in Louisville, Kentucky, in Freedom Hall. I'm sitting right next to Kaywood Ledford, who was the voice of the Kentucky Wildcats, and in my estimation, one of the greatest basketball announcers of all time. And he's doing the game on WHAS in Louisville, and I'm doing it back to Columbus, Ohio, on WTVN radio. And I thought, boy, this is going to be fun doing this every year. But, of course, then I had to wait a couple of decades before I did another Final Four. But and the amazing thing about that was, here's Kaywood Ledford. I mean, he's just a legend. And some years later, I had several opportunities to work with him and be an analyst on the NCAA basketball tournament with Kaywood. He would do the play-by-play, and I would be his color man.
Phil, as you're recounting your experiences with WOIO, it makes me think it's quite appropriate that we're talking now on a campus university station.
Right, and I think campus stations are wonderful because it's just an opportunity to go out and find out what you can do. And the best thing is to do everything that's available.
For those of us, those of you just joining us, let me remind you that you're in the Communication Corner. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Lampton. Our guest today is truly legendary broadcaster, Phil Schaefer. Delighted to have you with us, and certainly Phil as well. Phil, during these early years when you had already chosen your career, a tough one to get into, sports broadcasting, were there any real sports broadcasting models that you had? Was there anyone that you said, gee, if I could just have a career like that person? Was there anyone that you studied as a role model?
Well, nobody that I really thought I would want to be like exactly, because you don't know where your career is going to take you. So I just thought, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do the best I can, and you know, I don't know where this is going to lead to. But I got some real breaks early, so I'm starting off a little bit higher than maybe I should have, as far as the kind of stations and I mean, doing Ohio State basketball while I'm still a student in college. I mean, that was kind of wild right there. But I had a couple of announcers that I really liked and studied, and one of them was a guy named Buddy Blattner. And Buddy Blattner did he was a former Major League Baseball player. He did the baseball game of the week with Dizzy Dean on television for a while. And he also did the Atlanta Hawks, the St. Louis Hawks on KMOX. And I could hear KMOX in Columbus, Ohio when I was in college. And I would listen to the Hawks games whenever I could because of Buddy Blattner. I liked the way he did a ball game. I liked the pictures that he drew for the audience. I liked the way he was friendly. He had this great, it was like he had a smile in his voice, and he was just kind of fun to listen to. So I really admired Buddy Blattner. I liked the way he presented a ball game, I had an opportunity to go down to Cincinnati and see the Cincinnati Royals play the St. Louis Hawks. And after the game, I went up and I talked to Buddy Blattner. And I told him that, you know, I really admired him as a broadcaster, and that's what I was going to do and was already doing. And he was so nice to me, and we talked. We probably talked for, I don't know how long, 15 or 20 minutes. And, I mean, he had to get out of there, and you know, when the game was over. But he spent a lot of time talking with me. And then what was really wild, probably a month or two later, I got a nice handwritten letter from Buddy Blattner that he sent to me about the things that we had talked about. And I thought that was – I couldn't believe that he would take the time to do that.
What a class act.
Oh, absolutely. And I admired this guy as a broadcaster, and then to find out what a nice person he was. But that's the way he came across on the air. So I like that.
Sometimes the two don't match. Arthur Godfrey was the king of radio, and one of the first who had a nationally popular talk show. And he came across as just the most congenial guy, you know, let's sit here and sip our Lipton tea together. And yet he wound up firing Julius LaRosa on the air. And from everything I ever heard about him, away from the mic, he was not the kind of guy you wanted to associate with.
Right. Buddy Blattner was the real thing. And that was a highlight for me to meet him and have him be so nice.
And later on, people, I'm sure, have said that about Phil Schaefer. I want to elaborate on something you said a minute ago, where you said that you liked the pictures that he drew for his listeners. I was thinking, Phil, about how radio really was it for sports for so many years. As I look back, I followed college football for many years. I grew up in South Mississippi, and of course, those were the days when Ole Miss was king of football. I remember some of the announcers that I would listen to who just made you feel like you were there. Every year in the Deep South, in the 1950s and even into the 1960s, the Ole Miss-LSU game was the game, not only regionally, but it was the game nationally as well. Still, I think Billy Cannon's run in 1959 may be the most famous football play in American football history. As I listened to that game, there was a broadcaster for LSU, John Ferguson, who just made everything seem so dramatic. And Bill Goodrich was the one, as I recall, for Ole Miss. And when Ole Miss would do anything good, he would say, "Lord, have mercy."
I knew John Ferguson, and a real gentleman, a nice man, a good broadcaster. Ole Miss, Stan Torgerson.
Yes.
He was a contemporary of mine. And then was Jack Crystal doing the games for Mississippi State back then?
I believe he might have been, and Lindsey Nelson with University of Tennessee.
Right.
Lindsey Nelson was the first broadcaster with the Vols Network. And the point I'm getting at here is, for so many decades, when it came to sports, we relied on the pictures, as you put it, that the announcers, the broadcasters, the commentators drew for us. What I have found most interesting is that for a lot of years, I listened to those big games before I could see them. I don't want to say that it was a letdown to see them, but I'll have to say that you lost some of the excitement, of the drama that came by the broadcaster announcing the game, and as you put it, drawing a picture in your mind. There truly was some magic to that, and still is.
Right, absolutely, and it's kind of amazing. I recently read a book by a sportscaster by the name of Ken Coleman, who did the Cleveland Browns and the Boston Red Sox games forever. And Ken Coleman talked about the fact that the radio listener kind of is in the game with you, and he sees what the listener sees, what he or she wants to see from what you tell them. And that's what kind of gives it the magic quality. I'd never heard that expressed that way before.
Yes, and it's like, for example, if you and I were having a conversation in a coffee shop and somebody overheard our conversation, some people would interpret it one way and some would interpret it another. Which brings me to the point. Sports broadcasters, except for some notable exceptions, Larry Munson being one of them, sports broadcasters are supposedly going to give us an unbiased reporting. This is a challenge, I would assume. How is it that you faced that challenge? How is it you tried to be what newscasters now are calling fair and balanced? How did you do that?
I always felt from the very beginning that my role was to describe what was going on. And for the listener, I wanted them to know exactly what was transpiring, but I didn't want to make decisions for them. So if they were rooting for a team, that was fine with me. And I just never took that route of being a cheerleader, I guess you could say. I don't know. I from the very beginning, that was the approach that I took. Now, I found in doing games, for example, when I did the Atlanta Hawks for 5 years, I did Georgia basketball play-by-play for 16 years, it's hard to describe something and not be prejudiced. I mean, when you're traveling with the Georgia basketball team and you know Dominique Wilkins and Terry Fair, and a call goes a certain way, it gets a little frustrating. And every once in a while, you will make a comment about it didn't look this way or it didn't look that way. But it really bothers me sometimes when I hear some announcers that spend half their game officiating the game. And I didn't tune in to hear them officiate. I tuned in to hear what was going on mm-hmm. the court. Mm-hmm. So that was the approach that I took. Tell the listener what is going on and just try to make them see it in their own mind.
And you weren't yelling, "Run, Lindsay, run."
No, but Larry Munson was yelling that, and when he finished, I turned to him and I said, "Well, Larry, you wanted a miracle, and we just got one." And then when I looked at Larry, he wasn't there. He was gone. He'd left the room.
Well, the story I always heard, he may have broken the chair.
He broke the chair, but, you know, if I'd have broken the chair, I'd have still stayed there. Yeah, that was a great moment. And you talk about the Billy Cannon run. I'd have to put the Lindsey Scott run right up there with that.
Phil, talking about impartiality brings me to the language that the broadcaster uses. We're going to take about a 2 or 3 minute break here. When we come back, I know that our listeners are going to be very interested in hearing your comment about all the worn out, tired cliches that we hear from broadcasters in every sport and what you did to guard against that. Back with Phil Schaefer in just 2 or 3 minutes. Stay tuned, please.
Over 30 years of quality music and programming, WBCX 89.1, the voice of Brunel.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? Would you feel scared or proud? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Would you rather make your own way than spend a lifetime saying, "What if?" Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or go to peacecorps.gov.
Hi, I'm Gail Dunn, and I'd like to invite you to join me on Garage Gab every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. On Garage Gab, we'll find a way to help you solve your car dilemmas and save you money. Again, that's 9 a.m. on Wednesday mornings here on the Voice of Brunel.
My name is Jamali Rashears. With my local United Way, I help promote academic achievement and give kids a reason to stay in school. I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Senior Issues is a radio show devoted to promoting quality issues to help our seniors maintain or improve their quality of life. Also, the show could help those with seniors in their family be aware of the various issues that would affect both them and their loved ones. Showtime is 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. every Thursday, and yes, we are live. We will cover a wide range of subjects over the course of time. If you have a subject that you would like discussed, or if you know of an event that our listening audience should be aware of, call me at 770-380-9727. This is Charles White, Certified Senior Advisor. I hope that we can add you to our listening audience.
Real stories from Brunel University students.
There's two things in life I am 100% dedicated to: earning my MBA and serving my country. Well, those two commitments clashed when the Army mobilized my National Guard unit right in the middle of my MBA semester. I thought I'd have to drop my classes, but I go to Brunel University, and no one supports working adults more than Brunel. My professors and I, and here's why I love Brunel, we worked out a way for me to finish my semester. I've taken classes in every conceivable format, online, evening and weekend, and even classes at different Brunel campuses. My life took a real change, but my MBA studies didn't. If you're looking for a program that's flexible and supportive, then you belong in a Bernal classroom.
Classes in Atlanta, Gainesville, and online start every 8 weeks. Register at gobernau.com. That's GOBRENAU.com. Bernal University. Our support, your success.
Mace here, your host for Mace on Film. Catch us at our new time on Thursday evenings at 6, right after the BBC Hour. And don't forget to catch Broadway Revisited right after Mace on Film at 7 p.m. on 89.1 WBCX, the voice of Brenau. So remember, that's Mace on Film, Thursdays at 6 p.m., where we discuss film music, film history, and sometimes film gossip.
Hello, I'm Dr. Bill Lampton. Welcome back to the second half of the Communication Corner with my most interesting guest, the highly accomplished sports broadcaster, Phil Schaefer. Just before the break, Phil, I mentioned that I wanted to ask your opinion about the worn-out cliches that so many people, whether they're listening to radio or television sports, have to endure. I remember my wife, Sandra, and I were watching a football game. I believe it was at the end of last season. And the broadcaster said at first, it looks like the quarterback has not found his rhythm. It was okay that he said that one time. I think we lost count after 16 times later in the game how much he said he had not found his rhythm. Or, you know, this kid gives 100% on every play. What did you do, Phil, to avoid those tired phrases and say something fresh at least most of the time?
Well, before I answer that, you know, you talked about the number of times that he said it. I remember doing the SEC basketball tournament one year, and Tennessee was playing, and I had a statistician, and I said, now, I want you to keep the points and, of course, and the fouls and et cetera. And I said, I have one other stat I want you to keep. I want you to keep the number of times they play Rocky Top. And so we were keeping count on that. But getting back to your question, sometimes it's really hard not to use some of those cliches. Now, the one that you brought up about somebody giving 100% or 110%, I've never used that one single time because, to me, every athlete puts out as much energy as they have on every single play. So that's a sort of a silly cliche to use. And maybe sometimes an athlete won't put out as much as he did on a previous play, but that could be because of the circumstances. He may be very tired. He may be injured. I mean, but he's still putting out as much effort as he has in his body. That is one cliche that just bugs the daylights out of me.
And don't they all probably put on their game face when they come in?
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to say that.
Yeah, but every announcer has certain phrases that they like to use. And what you have to be very careful of is not to overuse any phrase. And I used to go back and listen to my games and see what I said to make sure I wasn't overusing certain phrases or doing something that would annoy the listener.
I've done the same thing as a professional speaker. I'll see the videotape of a presentation I made. I want to find out, were there phrases and words that I repeated too much? Because after a while, it does annoy the audience. I noticed in your book where you talked about your learning stage, that you did listen, you re-listened to many of your broadcasts, and that's a great way, if you're candid, to analyze yourself and to improve. Phil, you talked in the first half of the program about the basketball coach at Ohio State helping you learn more about basketball. There's an amusing story about how Vince Dooley helped you learn more about football. Vince said to you, well, you know, if you're going to really know what this is like, you need to do some workouts with us. I think this was 1979. Share with us what your experiences were putting on the pads and going at it with the team.
Vince really suckered me in. He got me to go out there and report with the freshman players and go through the first week of practice without pads. Now, that sounds pretty simple. And Vince said, there's nothing to it. The only thing you'll have to do is run a mile. And so I thought, okay, I can get myself set up to do that. But he didn't tell me that we would run the mile after we had done all these other exercises and all these other drills. I was worn out when it came time to run the mile. But I did not finish last, thank goodness. There were a couple of other players. Of course, they were real players that finished behind me.
But these guys were all much younger than you.
Oh, yes, much younger. Much younger, 25 years younger.
Which certainly added to the challenge.
And it certainly shocked some of the players when they came out for that first day of practice and looked at me and thought, what is this old guy doing out here?
Well, there's something, too, about when you were asked to punt and you kicked a ball about 20 yards.
Well, here's the story on that. We were going through some drills, and it was they moved me around from position to position because they never could really find the right spot for me. they kind of figured out maybe receiver was where I belonged, and of course they used me at running back a little bit. And we're going through some drills, and I'm running through these players, and they're hitting me with these big pads, and that didn't feel too good. Even though we weren't supposed to be in pads yet, you're still getting knocked all over the place. So when they said all the punters report to such and such a place, I thought this is one way to get out of getting knocked all over the place. So I ran down with the punters. Now I'm standing down there, and there were about four or five of us, and I took a snap and I kicked the ball, and it was a terrible kick. And Bill Hartman came ambling up, the old coach for the Bulldogs, who had coached the special teams and the kickers in particular forever. And he was a great coach and a great man. And he walks up next to me, and he can't see me because I've got my helmet on. So I take a snap, and I get away another terrible kick. And Bill Hartman says to me, where are you from, son? And I said, North Augusta. And he said, North Augusta, many years ago, we had a great player from North Augusta by the name of Charlie Brett. I said, yes, sir. I played ball with Charlie. Well, he just paused forever, and he said, he just kept, it was like, what's going on here? Charlie Brett played for us back in the 60s.
The math didn't work.
No, and he says, you been in the Army or something? And I said, yes, sir, I was in the Army. And he says, well, what's your name? I said, Schaefer. He says, well, Schaefer, we're going to have to check on your eligibility. So anyway, at that point, I took my helmet off, and I turned around and I looked at him and said, Coach, it's me. And he looked at me and was like, what in the world are you doing here?
Well, that whole experience gave you a deeper appreciation for what the players go through to get ready for a season or a game.
I can never forget the first time I carried the ball from the fullback position. Guy McIntyre clobbered me.
And it still hurts.
No, it's finally gone away.
With the University of Georgia football program, you were known as the color man for radio. Many listeners don't understand what that means. What is the color man?
Well, the color man kind of fills in. The play-by-play man tells you who carried the ball and describes it, and then the color man comes in and gives you more details and fills in with statistics or talks about maybe the blocking or a tackle or something that was particular to that play and fills in the gap.
While we're on the topic of University of Georgia football, any listener who keeps up with sports at all knows that there's a new athletic director on the scene. What's your familiarity with Greg McGarrity, and what do you predict for his time as athletic director at UGA?
Greg McGarrity, when I first came to the University of Georgia as a broadcaster, was working in sports information and handled basketball. And so I knew Greg many years ago. And Greg is just a wonderful person. I hated it when he left the University of Georgia and went to Florida. But he went down there, and he was able to do even more things in the athletic department at Florida. Now, he had worked his way up at Georgia and was also had done a lot of different things at Georgia. But now he's come back to Georgia, and I think Greg McGarrity is going to do a whale of a job. He is a great person. He's really a dedicated professional, and I don't think they could do any better. I'm a big fan of Greg's, and I'm just pleased as I can be that they hired him as athletic director. They couldn't have done any better.
From everything I hear and read, that's a pretty widespread consensus right now.
Right.
In your career, you have met and watched some very colorful characters. Let's talk about a couple of them. One is, there was a football game, Ohio State playing Purdue. Woody Hayes. The scene is halftime. Take it from there, Phil.
I'm sitting in the press box at Ohio State, and I'm working for WOIO, and so I have my seat in the press box. And at halftime, in a game that is tied, the two teams left the field. And when they left the field, they had to crisscross each other to get to their locker rooms. The benches weren't on the same side of the field as the locker room, so they crisscrossed, and Purdue went into their locker room, and then Ohio State headed to their locker room. But when they got to it, they didn't stop. The team just kept running, and they ran right out of the stadium. I mean, it was like the football team was leaving. They were going, where are they going?
Game's not over.
Right, it's halftime. And are they going home? What's going on here? No, they ran out to the practice field. And on the practice field, there is Woody Hayes, and Woody Hayes is running this one play, this off-tackle play, over and over and over again. Woody Hayes had him out there at halftime practicing. And, I mean, Woody did some very strange things, and that was one of them. They tell the story about the time that he had the football team up in Lansing, Michigan. He was going to play Michigan State. And they're staying at a hotel right across the street from the golf course. And on Saturday morning, Woody gets everybody up early. They go out on the golf course, and Woody has them running through plays on the golf course. Can you imagine some guy gets up on number 7, gets ready to tee off, and looks down the fairway, and there's the Ohio State football team running plays?
A surprising and awesome sight.
That was Woody Hayes.
Then let's talk about Bear Bryant. You were told early in your career, don't bother calling him. He's not very good to broadcasters. What was your experience in contacting and dealing with Bear Bryant?
The reason nobody wanted me to call Bear Bryant or recommended that I not call Bear Bryant was the fact that he didn't like Atlanta. That's what I was told. He didn't like Atlanta because of an article about him in the Saturday Evening Post that Furman Bisher had written, and a very controversial article. So apparently Bear Bryant just didn't have any use for anybody in Atlanta.
It was talking about potentially the game had been thrown.
Right. And, of course, that greatly offended the Bear. So we did a show on WSB. Actually, we carried what they called the Pick of Dixie football games. When we didn't have a Georgia game on, we had another game from the Southeastern Conference. And I did a show called Football Warm-Up that ran before these Pick-a-Dixie shows, where I had the coach from each team on. So we had Alabama playing somebody. It may have been Clemson. And of course, that was great because then I could call Frank Howard, and he was really a piece of work. But I called Bear Bryant, even though I was told, don't waste your time. I called him. He wasn't available. I left a message, and I thought, well, he'll probably never call me back. And lo and behold, 2 hours later, I get this call, and somebody says, Bear Bryant's on the phone for you. So I went to the phone. I explained who I was, what I wanted to do, and he very graciously gave me an interview. I talked to him about the upcoming game, and every time after that, I would call him and tell him, we're carrying your game. I want to do an interview with you. And every time, he would give me an interview. Now, I will have to say, he said nothing. I mean, Bear Bryant would just grumble in that voice of his, and it was amazing to hear him talk because
it's more of a growl than a conversation.
Yeah, and but you know, he would talk about his football team. When I say he just never gave you much insight, but he talked to you.
One of the other characters that you ran across is somebody who's known to us as a famous, highly successful comedian, Jonathan Winters. What was your acquaintance with him?
Jonathan Winters, I met when I was a youngster. My uncle, by the name of Carl Sell, worked at WBNS-TV in Columbus, Ohio, and he was one of three staff announcers. And there were three, the three staff announcers were, there was my uncle, Carl Sell, there was Jonathan Winters, and there was Jack Buck. And Jack Buck, of course, went on to go into the Baseball Hall of Fame as a great baseball announcer, and of course he also was a great football announcer. And now his son Joe Buck does all the various sports on Fox. But Jonathan Winters worked at WBNS, and he was the host of the late night movie. Back in those days, there was no Tonight Show. Once you did the local news at 11 o'clock, all the TV stations could do was show movies. There wasn't anything else left for them to put on air, and then they'd show a movie, and then when the movie was over, they'd sign off. Well, Jonathan Winters, along with his duties as an announcer, he also hosted the late-night movie on WBNS-TV, and he was always a riot introducing the movie. But also back then, all the station breaks were done live. Things were a lot different in television in those days, so you had to have an announcer on duty. And I would go to the TV station with my uncle, and Jonathan Winters would be there, and I'd play checkers with him every once in a while. And he was really a character. I had a great uncle who was a great outdoorsman, and he took Jonathan Winters fishing with him a couple of times. And he got so disturbed. He would come home and he'd say, "Johnny Winters, he just talks to everything. He talks to the fish. You can't sit there and fish with him.
Can't shut the guy up."
Right. He said, and he was being entertained by one of the greatest comedians of all time.
Phil, before we started our broadcast today, you shared with me something that one friend would share with another. You were showing me the program from a wonderful tribute that you received at the Masters Golf Tournament. Let's talk about that.
Very honored this year to be the recipient of the Masters Major Achievement Award, which they give to reporters who have covered the Masters for 40 or more years. And I was one of seven reporters so honored. Lauren Smith was also honored at the same time. Lauren had 49 years as covering the Masters, and this was my 45th year. So quite an honor. And just a wonderful ceremony. My family loved it because they all got tickets to go, especially my wife, who had been complaining she hadn't been able to go to the Masters and see it very often because I didn't get tickets. I got my credential, and that was it. But this year, she sat on the veranda, had lunch on the veranda, could go anywhere she wanted to. She absolutely loved it. We had a great time. It was wonderful having to even have the children come in and come to the ceremony that they had in the press building where we were honored. And it was a privilege for me to have my name put up on the award with people like Dan Jenkins and Kay Kessler and some of the really great people in journalism over the last several decades.
Let's not overlook mentioning your wife, Karen, who was a cheerleader for the Buffalo Bills. I think they were called the Buffalo Jills.
Right.
And as I remember, Phil, wasn't she there during the O.J. Simpson and other great players era?
Joe Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were a lot of great players there. So she was a cheerleader with them for, I think it was 5 years.
Those of you just joining us, we're in the last quarter hour of the Communication Corner. I'm Dr. Bill Lampton with our very special guest, Phil Schaefer. Phil, as we think about the Masters, automatically many people think about Jack Nicklaus. Gosh, you had an early start in getting acquainted with Jack Nicklaus. Explain that to us.
We had an ROTC class together at Ohio State. We were classmates, and I really didn't know Jack all that well in college. I mean, we had class together, and I may have interviewed him a couple of times, but I really didn't get to know him until after we both got out of college and he was on the tour, and then I would see him all the time. But I got to know Barbara his wife really well. In those days, she was Barbara Bash, and we had a comp lit class together. We had the same class for three straight quarters. We sat right next to each other, and Barbara is just a very wonderful person. She's a class act all the way down.
This brings me to ask, anybody who picks up the paper today, turns to the sports section, or now it may even be on the front page, or anybody who's listening to radio and television sports commentators, they're going to hear about all the bad things that are happening with athletes and even with coaches and other officials. Arrests, convictions, DUIs, burglaries, other crimes. From what I know of your career, you think of those as exceptions because you have known some athletes who live exemplary lives, unselfish lives, and have contributed greatly to society. Let's hear you talk about, for example, what you've done for Huntington's disease and how some athletes have helped you with that cause.
Well, I got involved with Huntington's disease when I was working at WSB Radio, and one of our engineers, Mason Thompson, his mother died, and they discovered at that time that she died because she had Huntington's disease, and they did not even know it was in their family until that happened. And at that time, they really didn't know as much about Huntington's disease as they do now. And so eventually Mason Thompson got Huntington's disease, and it killed him as well, because there is no cure for Huntington's disease. Once you get it, it destroys you little by little, and it works on your nervous system. At any rate, I was asked to help with the Huntington's Disease Society, and they asked me if I could find an athlete who could be a spokesman for him. And I said, yeah, I know this young guy just came into Atlanta, and I think he would be perfect. He's just the kind of person that you would want to represent you, and his name is Dale Murphy. So I went to Dale, and he was very happy to be a spokesperson for Huntington's disease. And for many, many years after that, we did a lot of things together. And, yes, Dale Murphy is the kind of person that, you know, you wish every athlete was like. He's just a wonderful human being. And he contributed greatly to our success with raising money for Huntington's disease. I always felt like when you're in a position to help somebody, you should give back if you can. I feel like all athletes should do that because they're in a position to do it. Well, I was in a position to do it as a sportscaster, and so I got involved with the Atlanta Sports Collectors Association, and we put on a baseball card show. And then we took all the money and we gave it to Huntington's disease. And we ended up bringing in a lot of players to come in and sign autographs, and all that money went. Over the years, we probably raised over $500,000 for Huntington's disease. And guys like Phil Negro, Phil would come every year and sign autographs for people. He was wonderful. And then you had other athletes, Cleet Boyer, Pat Jarvis, Ron Reed, Tom Glavine, John Smoltz, and then a bunch of Georgia guys. Kevin Butler was always so gracious with his time, and Scott Warner, and I could just go on and on with all the great athletes that came in. And I felt that was my opportunity to give something back.
And those stories don't make headlines.
No, they don't make headlines. I can remember Bobby Cox coming one year, and Bobby was leaving the show. He'd been signing autographs. And the thing about it is we didn't pay any of these people to do this. They came and gave of their time. And Bobby Cox was leaving, and this man walks up to Bobby Cox, and he says, Bobby, my wife has just been diagnosed with Huntington's disease. Would you talk to her? And there was a payphone right there, and he grabbed the payphone, and he called his wife. And here's Bobby on the payphone telling this man's wife that, you know, that there were people that were going to help her and they were going to do this. And poor Bobby really didn't know that much about Huntington's disease, but he was trying to do what he could for this man's wife to make her feel comfortable. Now, that's a tribute to Bobby Cox, I'll tell you that. And he is a great man and has been a good friend for years. He's going to be missed in baseball when he retires. I think he is just truly one of the greatest managers of all times.
Phil, as we're moving into our final very few minutes, I do not want to leave out the contributions that you made after your full-time broadcasting career. When you became affiliated with the DeKalb County school system and you used your media and production skills so well there, what was that all about?
I was asked by the superintendent, Dr. Robert Freeman, if I could help get young people scholarships. And this came at a time in my life where I'd kind of burn out on working in the studio, and I thought about the challenge involved, and I accepted it, went with the school system, worked in the athletic department. It was a great opportunity. It's one that wouldn't come along very often in education because you have to have a fearless leader like Dr. Freeman, who was a superintendent, and he took a real risk hiring somebody from outside to do something like this. The bottom line, though, is that it did pay off $100 million in athletic scholarships while I was there with the school system, and they gave me freedom to do whatever I wanted to do. So it was a fun job. I could be as creative as I wanted to be, and they just turned me loose. And basically what I did was I went out and I went out and worked and did everything to promote our kids. And it really paid off. We did books. We did video forums. We did all sorts of things. And it was all based on getting coaches to come in and look at our kids, and it paid off.
And so many of those kids who would not have gotten college athletic scholarships otherwise were able to do that because of your promotional efforts.
Yeah, we were very fortunate. And that was what he wanted me to do, was to help the kids that were in the gray area. He said, we don't have to help the blue chippers. And he was right. The blue chippers get their scholarships, but there are a lot of other kids that could play at smaller colleges, and those were the ones that we really put our efforts into, helping the kids go to a Presbyterian college or go play at Elon or Tennessee State or something like that.
And as a part of your agreement with the DeKalb County school systems, you were able to continue your media career as well.
Yeah, I was able to work at do the Georgia games, and then later the CBS radio college football game of the week. And, of course, I did the NCAA basketball tournament on CBS radio for 15 years. And I was able to do that, as you said, while I was working for the school system. And the two kind of overlapped, and it worked well for the school system.
Give me a quick 20 seconds on the Brett Favre charade, the annual will he or won't he. Is he going to be doing this at age 75?
Possibly, yes. I think he will. Really, I'll tell you what, it's become comical to me. But the biggest thing I've enjoyed about it is how mad it makes my wife, Karen. She gets mad every year. She says, oh, here we go again with Brett Favre. She says, he's a disgrace.
It'll happen again next year.
Probably will.
I'm sure. Phil, this has been not only a great personal reunion because you're a longtime friend, it's been a wonderful experience to talk to someone who has excelled as a broadcaster in every sport that's popular in America. I know that many of our people who have listened will want to contact you, and they will want to find out more about your book, Sins of a Southern Sportscaster, in which you include these and many other stories and retrace your career. Tell us your contact information, please, your website, phone number, whatever you'd like to share.
You can go to southernsportscaster.com, and that is the website, which shows you the front cover of the book and gives you a little bit of information. The foreword's by Dale Murphy, and it was a lot of fun to write the book. I wrote it for my grandkids because I wanted them to know a little bit more about their grandfather once I'm no longer walking this earth, so they could go back and they wouldn't get a chance to hear all the stories, so at least they'd have them in print.
Part of your legacy.
Right.
Give us that website one more time, please.
SouthernSportscaster.com. And then you can also order the book. Or you can go to Barnes & Noble. They have the book at Sins of a Southern Sportscaster.
This is Dr. Bill Lampton. Thank you for having been with us in the Communication Corner. You can read all of our previous blogs about these programs and access the audio on my blog, thecompletecommunicator.com. My telephone number, 678-316-4300. Would love to hear from you again, 678-316-4300. Thanks for being with us in the Communication Corner.